Okay, so here we go with chapter 17. In the 12th year of King Ahaz of Judah, Hoshea, son of Elah, began to reign in Samaria over Israel. He reigned 9 years. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, yet not like the kings of Israel who were before him. King Shalmaneser of Assyria came up against him. Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute. But the king of Assyria found treachery in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to King So of Egypt, and offered no tribute to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria confined him and imprisoned him. Then the king of Assyria invaded all the land and came to Samaria. For 3 years he besieged it. In the 9th year, Hoshea, the king of Assyria, captured Samaria. He carried the Israelites away to Assyria. He placed them in Halah on the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. This occurred because the people of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They had worshipped other gods and walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel, and in the customs that the kings of Israel had introduced. The people of Israel secretly did things that were not right against the Lord their God. They built for themselves high places at all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. They set up for themselves pillars and sacred poles on every high hill and under every green tree. There they made offerings on all the high places, as the nations did whom the Lord carried away before them. They did wicked things, provoking the Lord to anger. They served idols, of which the Lord had said to them, "You shall not do this." Yet the Lord warned Israel and Judah by every prophet and every seer, saying, "Turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes in accordance with all the law that I commanded your ancestors and that I sent to you by my servants the prophets." They would not listen, but were stubborn as their ancestors had been, who did not believe in the Lord their God. They despised his statutes and his covenant that he made with their ancestors and the warnings that he gave them. They went after false idols and became false. They followed the nations that were around them, concerning whom the Lord had commanded them that they should not do as they did. They rejected all the commandments of the Lord their God and made for themselves cast images of 2 calves. They made a sacred pole, worshipped all the host of heaven, and served Baal. They made their sons and daughters pass through fire. They used divination and augury, and they sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. None was left but the tribe of Judah alone. Judah also did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the customs that Israel had introduced. The Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel. He punished them and gave them into the hand of plunderers until he had banished them from his presence. When he had torn Israel from the house of David, they made Jeroboam, son of Nebat, king. Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them commit great sin. The people of Israel continued in all the sins that Jeroboam committed. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had foretold through all his servants the prophets. So Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria until this day. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria in the place of the people of Israel. They took possession of Samaria and settled in its cities. When they first settled there, they did not worship the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So the king of Assyria was told, "The nations that you have carried away and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the law of the God of the land. Therefore he has sent lions among them. They are killing them because they do not know the law of the God of the land." Then the king of Assyria commanded, "Send there one of the priests whom you carried away from there. Let him go and live there and teach them the law of the God of the land." So one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and lived in Bethel. He taught them how they should worship the Lord, but every nation still made gods of its own and put them in the shrines of the high places that the people of Samaria had made, every nation in the cities in which they lived. The people of Babylon made Sukkoth-Benoth, the people of Cuth made Nargal, the people of Hamath made Ashima, the Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak. The Sepharvites burned their children in the fire of Adrammelech and Anammelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. They also worshipped the Lord and appointed from among themselves all sorts of peoples as priests of the high places who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. So they worshipped the Lord, but also serve their own gods, after the manner of the nations from among whom they have been carried away. To this day, they continue to practice their former customs. They do not worship the Lord, and they do not follow the statutes or the ordinances or the law or the commandment that the Lord commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. The Lord had made a covenant with them and commanded them, "You shall not worship other gods or bow yourselves to them or serve them or sacrifice to them, but you shall worship the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt with great power and with an outstretched arm. You shall bow yourself to him, and to him you shall sacrifice. The statutes and the ordinances and the law and the commandment that he wrote for you, you shall always be careful to observe. You shall not worship other gods. You shall not forget the covenant that I made with you. You shall not worship other gods, but you shall worship the Lord your God. He will deliver you out of the hand of all your enemies." They would not listen, however, but they continued to practice their former custom. So these nations worshiped the Lord, but also served their carved images. To this day, their children and their children's children continue to do as their ancestors did. The word of the Lord. Yeah. So, Hoshea becomes king of Israel, the last king of Israel. He reigned for about 9 years, from 732 to 724 BCE. His name means Savior. And on balance, he was viewed as a good king. There's no particular reason why he was categorized in that way. Because it really does not appear that there were any reforms during his reign. It's possible that since he's the last king of Israel before the conquest by Assyria and the exile of the people, that he's depicted as, you know, a good king compared to most of the others, to emphasize the fact that even though the fate of the kings and the nation were linked together, that even when good kings rose and instituted reforms and were faithful to God, the nation continued to persist in the ways of their ancestors. And so you can't pin God's punishment on these kings. You know, that's probably why the last king is considered to be a good king, even though he doesn't seem to do much different. And the key indication there is you don't get that whole, "And he followed the sins of his ancestor Rehoboam of Nebat." Now, Tiglath-Pileser dies. His son Shalmaneser V succeeds him to the throne. He's only there for about a year because he ends up getting assassinated. But I get ahead of myself. He threatens to invade. He extracts tribute. There's mention that Hoshea had formed an alliance with King So of Egypt. The problem is that the Egyptians kept pretty good records. There is no indication of any King So in any of the hieroglyphs or stelae or that we have available to us. So this is a little bit of a confusion. Maybe it was a different king that had a nickname or something. Who knows? Who cares? Shalmaneser V gets upset. You know, he's not getting the tribute that he was promised, so he invaded. He conquers most of the territory of Israel, besieges Samaria for 3 years, and he dies. He's succeeded by Sargon II. He was in charge for 17 years, 722 to 705 BC. And he actually effects the conquest roughly around 721 BCE. He carries off the people, puts them in Assyrian territory, and this was a way to really break a nation. You cart them off to a strange new place, separate them from one another, and you don't have problems with some vassal state that still has the basis for unity and might rebel against you in the future. This was common practice. And you see a lot of repetition here, sort of a summation of why this has happened. You hear a lot of talk about how God had liberated them from slavery to Pharaoh in Egypt and led them into the Promised Land. You hear a lot from the Ten Commandments that they received in the wilderness and how they'd forsaken all of these commandments and ordinances and statutes. And there are 10 violations mentioned in verses 7 through 17, but chief among them idolatry, which, you know, that's That's the opening two commandments. No graven images, you only worship me and no other gods. But they succumb to the temptation of hedging their bets by worshiping the gods of the neighboring nations. And God did not want them to do that because He wanted them to be unique. A monotheistic, or at least a monolatrous people who could spread the word of Yahweh to all the nations. And part of their mission, stretching all the way back to Abraham, was that the nations of the world would come to follow the one true God by their witness, which they screwed up. There's a word in here that talks about them being false to God. The literal translation of that Hebrew is wind or puff. And CO, which is one of the commentaries I've been consulting from the not the Interpreter series, I can't even remember now. I love this quote. The narrator notes that the people had gone after things ephemeral, and hence themselves became ephemeral. It refers to things that are insubstantial or unreliable. They will not last because they have chosen relationships that do not last. That's just sort of the perfect way to wrap up Israel's problem. Now, Israel getting knocked off, that's a warning to Judah, and they get about 150 years to not follow that warning. They do have a few reforming kings along the way. God did everything He could. He sent prophets. He sent seers. You know, they get Elijah and Elisha and other unnamed prophets. And, you know, sometimes they follow their advice, sometimes they don't. God has provided benefits. When they did take the prophet's advice, they oftentimes won battles that they had no business winning. It's just gotten real nasty. They were having children pass through fire. That's a euphemism for human sacrifice. There's reference to the two golden calves that Jeroboam set up to keep people from going to Jerusalem to worship at the temple so he could consolidate his power. Jeroboam. And so chapter 17 pretty much wraps it up for Israel. So what are your questions, your comments, your insights?
Michael, I have a question. On verse 10, it says they set up sacred stones and Asherah poles.
Mm-hmm. What? Asherah poles, yeah. We talked about this a long while back, and these are just kind of shrines. I'm totally blanking out about the Asherahs. Who remembers? Let me see if they're in some of these notes here.
Female.
It's a female deity.
For fertility.
I think it's fertility. Oh, yeah, it's all coming back now. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. They also could have been seen as lingus poles. In India, you find from ancient Hindu cults lingus poles, which, if you're not familiar, is basically a phallus that represents fertility. So, I mean, this place was just loaded with idol worship places. Yeah, Caroline.
After the Assyrian destruction of Israel, did the present day people name their country Israel?
Well, because that was the name that God gave to Jacob. You know, remember, Jacob had cheated his older brother Esau out of his inheritance, fled for his life, went to find a bride, ended up with two, and decided to come back and try to wrap things up with Esau. And he decides to spend the night alone on the shore of the river Jabbok. An angel, or maybe God, comes to wrestle with him, puts his hip out of joint, so he's rest of his life, people call him Gimpy, and said, "You're renamed Israel now."
The Lord renamed Israel.
Right, and so that name is permanent. And of course, when the Assyrians emptied out the territory of Israel, they brought in people from other places that they had conquered and settled them there. And the contrast here is not to make Israel look good. It's not to say, oh, okay, well, these people came in and they screwed up just as bad as the Israelites. even though, you know, God, you know, sent lions to eat him up. And so the king said, well, you know, we got to stop this. So I'm going to send a priest down to teach confirmation class so people understand how to worship this Yahweh guy. And, you know, they sort of did a two-track thing where they kept, you know, the gods that they'd been worshiping where they came from and instituted those practices in the territory of Israel. And they worshiped Yahweh too. And so what the contrast is here between these people from Babylon and Cuth and Hamath and the Avites and all that. This is to say, these foreigners did the exact same thing as God's chosen people did. This is how bad it's gotten. You behave so much like foreigners that when they come in, they have the exact same problems that you have. And you're in such bad shape that you can send priests from Bethel and say, no, 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 no. If you're going to live here, you really need to worship just Yahweh. Trust us on this, because we've been conquered and exiled just like you. And Lord knows what's going to happen to you next if you don't straighten out, fly right. And, you know, so despite that, they replicated Israel's idolatrous practices. But, you know, that's to make Israel look bad, basically.
So this is why the Samaritan in the parable is really, because he's not remotely Jewish.
Well, yes and no. You know, the tribes that were conquered by Assyria are kind of known as the 10 lost tribes, because unlike the tribes of Judah and Bethlehem, which after 70 years of exile in Babylon were allowed to return, and not all of them did, there's no indication that at some point there was a general amnesty for the people of Israel and they got to go back. Some of them did go back, and some of these people that were brought in from the east stayed and eventually became Yahwistic. But the issue between the Jews and the Samaritans had to do with some variant practices. They worshipped in different places. You know, the Samaritans continued to worship Yahweh outside of Jerusalem, which was problematic. They had different views on what was Scripture. For the Samaritans, it was only Torah. For the people who were identified as the Jewish people, they included much of what we now have in the Old Testament, particularly the prophets. So there was argument about that. I mean, when you're not reading out of the same Bible, it's hard to get along. And there was just a lot of bad blood going back a really long way. There are accusations that the Samaritans conquests that came after the return from Babylon were collaborators with people like Alexander the Great and the Romans and all this stuff. So that's why when you get the story of the Good Samaritan, things come in threes. Jesus is telling the story. The first two people pass the man by, leave him for dead, one of them being a priest who was so concerned with ritual defilement that he didn't want to even attempt to take his pulse, because if he had been dead, then he would have had to go through ritual cleansing rites. And so, you know, they know the third guy is going to be the good guy, and the sucker punch is, it's a Samaritan. You know, and people would not have liked that. And it's a bit of a twist of the knife there in terms of who's your neighbor.
Is Assyria largely where Iraq is?
No, that's Babylon. Assyria had territory. Of course, it fluctuated a lot. But Assyria's territory, including Israel after the conquest, would have been modern-day Syria, parts of Turkey and Azerbaijan, northern parts of Lebanon. Let me just consult with the map to make sure my brain is...
Northern.
Oh yeah, they were from the northeast. The Babylonians came from Iran and Iraq to the east. And Persian and Hellenistic. They did have some chunks of Iraq, but not very much, because Nineveh is located on the bank of the Euphrates. This is the Persian Empire. Assyrian Empire. Okay, here it is. I got you. Actually, no, they did have a pretty good chunk. Yeah. It looks like what happened was is they had a slice out of the southwest of what we now call Turkey. They had all of Israel. They had Syria, parts of Azerbaijan, and a big hunk of Iraq. And I think what happened was is the Babylonians pushed up and pushed Assyria out of most of Iraq. And then they went to the east and did a number on the Medes. That's what I remember. Yeah.
So this was, though, the end of the kingdom of Israel.
Yeah, they were done.
They were done.
Yeah.
Gone forever.
Should have brought my maps. Forgot my maps.
Mm-hmm. We need like a flip chart next.
Yeah.
We do. You would think somewhere.
Maybe I'm thinking of Alabama.
Maybe we'll find it in the Great Purge. We gotta empty all this space out in preparation for the renovations and expansions to come, and I imagine we will find some treasures.
I'm sure.
But mostly we will find things that go away.
Let me know when it's going to happen. I'll go on vacation then.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, do we want to go to 18? Because we can always come back to 17 if you want to. In the third year of King Hoshea, son of Elah of Israel, Hezekiah, son of King Ahaz of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord, just as his ancestor David had done. He removed the high places, broke down the pillars, and cut down the sacred pole. He broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the people of Israel had made offerings to it. It was called Nehushtan. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was no one like him among all the kings of Judah after him, or among those who were before him. For he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses. The Lord was with him. Wherever he went, he prospered. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. He attacked the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from watchtower to fortified city. In the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of King Hoshea, son of Elah of Israel, King Shalmaneser of Assyria came up against Samaria, besieged it, and at the end of 3 years took it. In the sixth year of Hezekiah, which was the ninth year of King Hoshea of Israel, Samaria was taken. The king of Assyria carried the Israelites away to Assyria, settled them in Hoa on the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the city of the Medes, because they did not obey the voice of the Lord, their God, but transgressed his covenant, all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. They neither listened nor obeyed. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, King Sennacherib of Assyria came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. King Hezekiah of Judah sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. The king of Assyria demanded of King Hezekiah of Judah 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. At that time Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorposts that King Hezekiah of Judah had overlaid, and gave it to the king of Assyria. The king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris, and the Rabshakeh with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. They went up and came to Jerusalem. When they arrived, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is on the highway to the fuller's field. When they called for the king, there came out to them Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, who was in charge of the palace, and Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, son of Asaph, the recorder. Then Rabshakeh said to them, "Say to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, on what do you base this confidence of yours? Do you think that mere words are strategy and power for war? On whom do you now rely that you have rebelled against me? See, you are relying now on Egypt, that broken reed of a staff, which will pierce the hand of anyone who leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who rely on him. But if you say to me, 'We rely on the Lord our God,' is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has removed, saying to Judah and to Jerusalem, 'You shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem'? Come now, make a wager with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses, if you are able on your part to set riders on them. How then can you repulse a single captain among the least of my master's servants when you rely on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? Moreover, it is without the Lord that I have come up against this place to destroy it. The Lord said to me, 'Go up against this land and destroy it.' Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and Shebna, and Joah, the son of, said to the Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants in the Aramaic language, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in the language of Judah within the hearing of the people who are on the wall." But the Rabshakeh said to them, "Has my master sent me to speak these words to your master and to you, and not to the people sitting on the wall, who are doomed with you to eat their own dung and to drink their own urine?" Then the Rabshakeh stood and called out in a loud voice in the language of Judah, "Hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, 'Do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you out of my hand. Do not let Hezekiah make you rely on the Lord by saying, "The Lord will surely deliver us, and this city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria." Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, "Make your peace with me and come out to me. Then every one of you will eat from your own vine and your own fig tree and drink water from your own cistern until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive oil and honey, that you may live and not die. Do not listen to Hezekiah when he misleads you by saying, 'The Lord will deliver us.' Has any of the gods of the nations ever delivered its land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of the Sepharvim, Hinnah, and Iva? Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Who among all the gods of the countries have delivered their countries out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand?" But the people were silent and answered him not a word, for the king's command was, "Do not answer him." Then Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, who was in charge of the palace, and Shebna the secretary, and Joah, son of Asaph the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him the words of the Rabshakeh. The word of the Lord. So if you'd like to read more about what happens in chapter 18, there are parallels in 2 Chronicles, chapters 29 through 32, and in Isaiah, chapters 36 through 39. Hezekiah is the king of Judah. He was there between around 687 BCE, and he was a good king. He was compared to David, and that's about as good as it gets. He went against the Philistines and captured some territory, very David and Solomon-like thing to do. He trusted in Yahweh. He destroyed all of these idolatrous shrines. He was a big-time reformer, up to the point where he broke the staff of Moses. And, of course, you remember that from Isaiah. He held up the staff, and it divided the waters of the Red Sea. He struck the rock in the wilderness, and the waters flowed out. And when he first went to Pharaoh to tell him, "Let my people go," he took his staff, threw it on the ground. It turned into a snake. He picked it up again. It turned into a staff. So, pretty cool artifact. But people had started worshiping it as a god. And so Hezekiah destroyed that too. Now, about halfway through Hezekiah's reign, Sennacherib is now the king of Assyria. And he had 24 years on the throne, around 705 to 681 BCE. And despite all of the things that Hezekiah had done to put people back on the right track, Sennacherib? Shalmaneser comes down wipes out Samaria and, you know, carts the Israelites off. So a little flashback there. And then Sennacherib comes and he starts beating up on Judah. He just swallows the place up. And Hezekiah doesn't understand. And so he sends emissaries to where the Assyrians are. And he says, you know, what's your problem with me? I'll pay you tribute. And he does. And he does it by stripping the temple bare. I mean,
how do you strip gold off the temple?
Well, I mean, it's easy. Yeah, you just chisel it off. You know, if you can get wallpaper off, you can get gold off. And in fact, the gold's probably easier. Yeah.
I was going to say.
And you know, we've talked about, you know, the magnitude of talents before: 300 talents of silver, 30 talents of gold. That's a big convoy you got going. But apparently Sennacherib isn't satisfied by the tribute, and at the same time thinks that Hezekiah has forged an alliance. And so he's angry. He sends his viceroy, called the Tartan. He sends his chief counselor, and then he sends Rabshakeh. And it's interesting that he does the talking, because he's the cupbearer of the king. And the cupbearer, you would think, would be a kind of lowly position, but it wasn't. Because the guy who hands you wine all day, you're pretty happy with. And in the Assyrian language, Rabshakeh means jerk. And not really, but one would presume based on the speech that he gave. So to face this trio, Hezekiah sends out Eliakim, who's his sort of chief of staff, Shebna, who is his secretary, and Joah, who's the keeper of the records. And those were very high-ranking positions in the court. And so they go out, and, you know, it's just like, what is your problem? And very arrogant. And, you know, not wholly unjustified. They're really on a roll. And accuses them of forging an alliance with Egypt, who apparently they view as an unreliable ally. Broken reed of a staff which will pierce the hand of anyone who leans on it. They're basically like, Pharaoh's just saying, yeah, I'll help you out, but when the opportune moment comes, he's going to stab you in the back. Then he starts blasphemously mocking their professed reliance on Yahweh. And he doesn't really understand the difference between Yahweh and the other gods that they worship, and the fact that this was a big no-no, and this is why Judah was getting in trouble. Because he says, you know, the people aren't going to support your king because he's destroyed all of these shrines and all of these altars. And besides that, he's probably made the gods associated with those places angry too. So I'm going to make you a bet. I'll give you 2,000 horses, but I don't even think you'll find enough men who support the king and have the courage to even get up on him. You know, that's the bet. And then he says, besides, I'm here on the instructions of your own God. Yahweh sent me to wipe you out. And then in verse 26, Eliakim says, listen, could you talk to us in Aramaic instead of Hebrew? Because people are sitting on the wall, and, you know, this is just between the six of us right now, okay? Let's not freak them out. And so he says, well, shouldn't they all hear, you know? Because they're just as doomed as you are, and they might as well get it out of the horse's mouth. And because if you don't do what we want, you're going to be drinking your own piss. I mean, just a nasty piece of work, this guy, you know. And no, he doesn't die later, sorry. And so, you know, then he starts to boom out. Don't listen to your king. He's lying to you. There's absolutely nothing he can do to help you. And your God can't either. And then this perverse offer that mirrors the promised land. You know, you'll go into a land with milk and honey and all this. He's like, you know, join with us. Give yourselves up and, you know, life will be the same way as it was before until we cart you off to another place. But when you get there, it's going to be just as good as this place. Trust us, trust us. It's going to be great. Because if you don't do what I say, you're all going to die. And these other nations and their gods couldn't protect them. So what makes you think that Yahweh's going to protect you? And the king says, don't say a word to him. Not a single word. Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah go back, report to Hezekiah. They got the clothes torn, which is a sign of great distress and of penitence in some cases. And thus endeth chapter 18. Assyrians were not nice. They were not nice.
This is really a fascinating chapter. It's a little different.
It is, yeah. Well, there's new material.
Well, you know. As fascinating as it is, in my weird mind, and we all know I have one, in verse 11, you mentioned Gozer. And I immediately thought of Gozer was one of the evil creatures in Ghostbusters. Totally distracted me from the rest of the chapter.
Well, that's a blast from the past.
Yes, it is.
I was a young man when I watched that the first time.
But it is fascinating, this chapter. It is different.
It really is.
So they're besieging Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
They conquered the rest of it and they're besieging Jerusalem.
But the Assyrians are not going to get the prize.
No.
God will intervene once more to preserve the house of David for at least another 150 years. You want to jump to 19?
Yes.
I don't want to rush anybody. This is where the prophet Isaiah comes into the story. When King Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes, covered himself in sackcloth, and went into the house of the Lord. And he sent Eliakim, who was in charge of the palace, and Shebna the secretary, and the senior priests, covered with sackcloth, to the prophet Isaiah, son of Amoz. They said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this day is a day of distress, of rebuke, and of disgrace. Children have come to birth, and there is no strength to bring them forth. It may be that the Lord your God heard all the words of the Reshebka, whom his master, the king of Assyria, has sent to mock the living God, and will rebuke the words that the Lord your God has heard. Therefore lift up your prayer for the remnant that is left. When the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, Isaiah said to them, say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid because of the words that you have heard, which the servants of the king of Assyria have reviled me. I myself will put a spirit in him so that he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land. I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. The Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria fighting against Libna, for he had heard that the king had left Lachish. When the king heard concerning King Tirhaka of Ethiopia, see, he has set out to fight against you, he sent messengers again to Hezekiah, saying, thus you shall speak to King Hezekiah of Judah, do not let your God on whom you rely deceive you by promising that Jerusalem will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. See, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all lands, destroying them utterly. Shall you be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered them, the nations that my predecessors destroyed, Gozan, Haran, Rezif, and the people of Eden who were in Tel Assar? Where is the king of Hamath, the king of Arpad, the king of the city of Sepharvaim? Sorry, I'm having trouble today. The king of Hena, or the king of Iva? Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. Then Hezekiah went up to the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, O Lord, the God of Israel, who are enthroned above the cherubim, You are God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. Hear the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. Truly, O Lord, the king of Assyria have laid waste the nations and their lands, and have hurled their gods into the fire, though they were no gods, but the work of human hands, wood and stone, and so they were destroyed. But now, O Lord, our God, save us, I pray you, from his hand, so that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you, O Lord, are God alone. Then Isaiah, son of Amoz, sent to Hezekiah, saying, Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I have heard your prayer to me about King Sennacherib of Assyria. This is the word that the Lord has spoken concerning him. She despises you. She scorns you, virgin daughter Zion. She tosses her head behind your back, daughter Jerusalem. Whom have you mocked and reviled? Against whom have you raised your voice and haughtily lifted your eyes? Against the Holy One of Israel. By your messengers you have mocked the Lord, and you have said, With my many chariots I have gone up the heights of the mountains to the far recesses of Lebanon. I felled its tallest cedars, its choicest cypresses. I entered its farthest retreat, its densest forest. I dug wells and drank foreign waters. I dried up with the sole of my foot all the streams of Egypt. Have you not heard that I determined it long ago? I planned from days of old what now I bring to pass, that you shall make fortified cities crash into heaps of ruins, while their inhabitants, shorn of strength, are dismayed and confounded. They have become like plants of the field and like tender grass, like grass on the housetops, blighted before it is grown. But I know your rising and your sitting, your going out and coming in, and your raging against me, because you have raged against me and your arrogance has come to my ears. I will put a hook in your nose and my bit in your mouth. I will turn you back on the way by which you came. And this shall be the sign for you. This year you shall eat what grows of itself, and in the second year what springs from that. Then in the third year, sow, reap, plant vineyards, and eat their fruit. The surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For from Jerusalem a remnant shall grow out, and from Mount Zion a band of survivors. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, He shall not come into this city, shoot an arrow there, come before it with a shield, or cast up a siege ramp against it. By the way that he came, by the same he shall return. He shall not come into this city, says the Lord, for I will defend this city to save it, for my own sake, and for the sake of my servant David. That very night the angel of the Lord set out, and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. When morning dawned, they were all dead bodies. Then King Sennacherib of Assyria left, went home, and lived at Nineveh. As he was worshiping in the house of his god Nisroch, his sons, Adrammelech and Sharezer, killed him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat. His son Esarhaddon succeeded him. The word of the Lord. Yeah, so Hezekiah sends Elohim, Shebna, and for some reason leaves out Joah to Isaiah. And Isaiah provides comfort. He says, don't worry, Yahweh is going to beat him back with a rumor. And the rumor is that the king Tirhaka, in some translations it says of Cush, Cush is Ethiopia, was allying with him. There's no evidence that that was actually true. And these rumors hearken back to 1 Kings 22, 2 Kings 7. Sometimes the way God works is to deceive Israel's enemies, and sometimes he uses it to deceive Israel's kings. Hezekiah goes into the altar, lays the letter from Sennacherib before Yahweh, and begs for help, which again just emphasizes that among his many predecessors and those who come after him, he was an awesome king. His appeal is very reminiscent of Moses's. He's like, listen, you remember when God's up on the mountain with Moses and they're making the golden calf, Aaron helps out with that, and God gets mad and he says, you know what, I'm sick of these people, I'm just going to wipe them out. And Moses says, no, wait a minute, if you do this, you're going to have a major PR problem. Because the whole business in Egypt was you demonstrating your sovereignty, the fact that you're the only one true God. So if you take us out in the wilderness just to slaughter everybody except for me, then what are the Egyptians going to think? You know, they were really impressed by what you did. But then they're going to say, well, what kind of God is that? Why would we follow him? So he's saying, you know, please, you gotta bail us out here, or the whole project is just going to go down in flames. And so, in the meantime, Rabshakeh goes back to his king because they're fighting in a different place. Sennacherib hears about Ethiopia. He sends back messengers saying, you know, basically what was said in chapter 18, you can't rely on other allies. You cannot rely on your God. We are whipping people left and right. None of their gods could help them. What makes you think you're any different? And so Isaiah sends back an oracle. And an oracle is where God speaks directly through the prophet. And so it has a very high degree of authority and authenticity. And this basically is God's response to the blasphemous mocking of the king of Assyria and his chief advisors, and all the nasty things that they said, and all their boastfulness. Oh, we've beaten all these people, and we've cut down their best trees, and, you know, we've drunk foreign waters, and this business at the end of verse 24, I dried up with the sole of my foot all the streams of Egypt. We're not really sure what's going on there, because there's no indication that they ever really made it that far, but, you know, that's kind of a boastful exaggeration that people make when they think they've got the stuff. And 25 and 26 is actually God saying, all of this bad stuff that's happened to you, that's me. That's not the foreigners. That's me punishing you for being idolaters. So it's not their power. The power that I gave for them to conquer you came from me. In 27, and there are parallels to this, and this is in your notes. If you go to Isaiah 10, verses 12 through 19, you sort of get a paraphrase of this. Also in chapter 14, verses 24 through 29. despite all of this, you know, I'm God, and I know the rising and sitting and going out and coming in of both Judah and of all the kingdoms of the earth. And in 28, he says, you know, I'm going to put a hook in your nose and a bit in your mouth. In other words, I'm going to reduce you to a farm animal. I'm going to push you back. And the house of Judah will be saved a remnant. You'll take root downward, which means this isn't a temporary thing. You'll rise up to bear fruit. The Assyrians aren't going to get into Jerusalem, because I'm going to demonstrate my sovereignty to them. I'm doing this for the house of David because I made a covenant. And then the angel of the Lord, and again this harkens back to the 10th plague of Egypt, the Passover, where the angel killed the firstborn of all Egypt. The angel goes out and wipes out 185,000 soldiers. Again, in Samuel and Kings, numbers are very exaggerated, but you're talking about a massive slaughter. Massive slaughter. So King Sennacherib gets the hint, goes home, and doesn't stay for very long because his sons kill him. Maybe because he didn't manage to kill Jerusalem, maybe because they were ambitious. Whatever the case, it seems like that they realize, whoops, maybe shouldn't have done that, so they run away. And so a different son of Sennacherib ascends to the throne, Esarhaddon. And the sign that God is going to rescue Judah is that for a couple of years, they're just going to eat what comes up from the field. I mean, you know how it is. You plant your garden, you put in some corn. The next year, you decide, I don't feel like it. And the corn comes up anyway. And this is a sign that God will provide the people's needs. It kind of reminds you of the manna and the quail that he sent in the wilderness so they wouldn't starve to death. And then in the third year, life will sort of get back to normal, and you'll be able to practice agriculture again. There's also just a little bit of hint of the Jubilee year in here. So you get like a double Jubilee where the land lies fallow, and the people rely on God for the provision. And that's the sign that the Assyrians will be destroyed by the angel and pushed back. So that's chapter 19.
Is there another verse in the Bible about that? Because this reminds me of it. I know you're sitting down and you're going out and you're coming in. Where is that?
You find it in the Psalms. You find it in Isaiah.
Okay. That's so familiar. Right?
Yeah.
Yes, it's 139 where, beautiful, beautiful affirming psalm. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. So, you know, better not pout, you better not cry. And I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping. He sees you when you wake. I mean, he's a creepy guy. He's just a really creepy guy. Not God, Santa Claus. Yes. It's a clear day, but I still don't want to be struck by lightning.
God ordain or give the Syrians all of that power. What was his reasoning behind that?
Well, God decided that ultimately, after the better part of three centuries, that this whole monarchy project the people wanted, so they could be like their neighbors, and which God had big doubts about from the very beginning, he sort of let that run out its course. And once they became like their neighbors in having a king, they became like their neighbors in practicing idolatry. And generally that was initiated by the king, usually by marrying foreign wives. And so the punishment fits the crime. And they've broken the covenant relationship time and time again. God has been very patient. God has been very forgiving. But there just comes a point where the only way people will learn is for an awful tragedy to occur. You know, it's kind of like somebody with a substance abuse problem. They're not going to start their way back up again until they've hit rock bottom most of the time. And so this conquest and exile is rock bottom. There's nothing worse imaginable. It would have been better for God to just kill all of them than for them to have to live in slavery. And again, the narrator notes, and again quoting from Cio, that the people had gone after things ephemeral and hence themselves became ephemeral. It refers to things that are insubstantial or unreliable. They will not last because they have chosen relationships that do not last. So the scripture is very, very clear. You got conquered because God empowered your neighbors to do it because you have been unfaithful.
So where does that put the Jews with the Holocaust?
That's an excellent question. I'll be honest, I don't know, or I don't remember.
Well, I don't know if there's an answer to that, really, but you can find some kind of formula for what's happening in this story. Mm-hmm. In many stories, maybe, but.
Yeah, World War II and the Holocaust were devastating to Judeo-Christian religion. Just devastating. I mean, you hear stuff about how membership and attendance at worship in Western Europe and the United Kingdom are exceedingly low. And the turn came with World War II. Because after all of the destruction, all of the atrocities, you have a massive theological problem. Huge, huge. And actually, when I was in college, we had a man who had written a book, and I have his book, but I read it 25 years ago, so I remember next to nothing about it, that was talking about how do you construct a theology after the Shoah. How do you do that? And I think one of the ways that you sort of manage is through Zionism. The Shoah was what was necessary for us to be restored to the promised land. And it's not necessarily a punishment for the people, but it was what was required for us to be able to reclaim from our enemies what is rightfully ours. So that's a response. But, you know, there are more sort of secular Jews than there are practicing Jews. And so you see a similar phenomenon there as with the church, that for some people, the paradox is unresolvable even to this day. Yes? Yeah, well, you see that even in the Old Testament, where you see a transition from prophecy to apocalyptic thought. The second half of Daniel is apocalyptic in nature, and the books written in the intertestamental period, roughly from about 400 BC to the first century AD, are exceedingly apocalyptic, because the prophets kept saying that God works out His purposes through history, even when sometimes it's not really nice. Apocalyptic thought basically had become impatient with prophecy, because after the people came back from Babylon, they never really regained their freedom. You know, they just, one nation after another, buzzed through there. You know, Alexander the Great was that 4th century B.C., and then you have the Assyrians again in the 2nd century B.C., and then, you know, in the latter part of the 1st century B.C., then the Romans swoop in. And so people are like, what gives? And so they're like, you know, maybe we've misunderstood, or maybe God's decided to act in a different way. And so what's going to happen is there's going to be a moment in time where history ends, and God intervenes decisively with a great final battle where the righteous will be rewarded, the wicked will be punished, and the travails of history will be no more. And Israel will be restored in all of its glory and more so.
This is the thinking now?
For some, yes.
Europe and World War II. It's my understanding that the Lutheran Church in Germany was very accepting of Nazism.
Yeah. The Catholic Church, the Lutheran Church, which in Germany is generally known as the Reformed Church, they were largely complicit. And in some cases, supportive. And
say nothing of the Pope, whatever his name was.
It's
as well.
It's very hard for us to judge them, I think, because it's difficult to imagine the immense pressure that they were under. because resistance was, especially explicit resistance, was dealt with swiftly and harshly. And I think that they were just hoping that they could survive this.
So they thought Mussolini would take them out if they didn't do X, Y, and Z?
Oh, you mean in Italy? Yeah, I was talking about Germany, but Italy's pretty much the same way. The Vatican sort of made a deal with Mussolini that it was like, you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone.
Except there was some priest, I forget his name, in Germany.
Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were people who resisted, and most of them, like Bonhoeffer, were killed. In fact, he was, I can't remember which camp, I think they had him in Flossenbürg, is that right? Whatever concentration camp they had him in, they killed him just a few days before it was liberated, purely out of spite.
Saying is that, Hitler did not, Hitler was elected.
Yeah.
he did not, well, he did have his own private army, so to speak.
He did.
Well, he tried the other way and that didn't work.
Well, it was not a majority. They won a plurality of the votes in a very divided parliamentary system. That gave them enough votes in the Reichstag that they could form a coalition with some smaller like-minded parties and put an enormous amount of pressure on the president for Hitler to be placed in the chancellorship. And he didn't want to do it. You know, he held Hitler in contempt. But the problem was that German democracy never functioned well, despite the best efforts of some very courageous and bright people. And a big part of the issue was the economy was a nightmare because the terms of the Versailles Treaty were so punitive. And I mean, this is a nation that, even though very little actual fighting in World War I occurred on German soil, they were just exhausted by the war effort and the British blockade and the loss of an entire generation of young men. They'd had election after election after election. When you have really frequent elections in the parliamentary system, every subsequent election weakens the government's ability even more. And they basically told Hitler, yeah, you can be the chancellor. If we can stick these guys in your cabinet, they'll be the grown-ups in the room, a moderating influence, and it won't get too bad. They were wrong, because shortly after becoming the chancellor, masterfully manipulated parliament into giving him extensive executive powers. He abused those powers, and within a matter of a couple of years, he was the dictator of Germany. But a majority of Germans didn't vote for Hitler until basically it was pretty much a done deal. And part of the reason why they did that was he began to get the Nazi Party began to get those majority votes at a time when he was actually helping the economy recover. He was generating work projects, constructing the Autobahn. And the wars and the persecution of the Jews were way down the line.
Tried to stay clear of that person, didn't they? I mean, that was Himmler and the others' responsibility for the final solution. I mean, he didn't come out openly, at least at first, I don't think.
Well, no, it's quite clear in Mein Kampf. What his program was. And I can't blame people at that time for not reading Mein Kampf, because it's an ugly and ill-written book. But if Stalin would have read Mein Kampf, he wouldn't have been such an idiot. And I think for those who did, they said, well, you know, he's spouting off. He wrote this way back in the early 1920s, and he doesn't really mean it. He did. He meant every word in that book, and he executed the plan almost precisely in the course of that book. And you're right, Bud, Hitler did try to distance himself when it came to things like the final solution. Nothing in writing ever came out of the chancellery.
And they were noted for taking everything down in writing.
Yeah. And, you know, he would give suggestive verbal orders that were then executed by people like Himmler and Heydrich. You know, they formulated the final solution at a conference at Wannsee, and Hitler was not present. And neither was Goering, for that matter. And I don't think Himmler was there either. So this was... No, wait.
It was Heydrich.
It was Heydrich, yeah.
It shows that when he was in the minority, that people, by not agreeing to get together to prevent him, if you can see it happening in places today over the world where someone gets into power,
a
minority, and then the majority don't come together.
He was Christ, but his believer.
He was a very charismatic figure, and he was a gifted orator, particularly in tapping into the grievances of people and telling them what they wanted to hear. He was just, that frankly was one of his few and only gifts. He was a terrible administrator, although he was able to select people who were good at it.
Pretty good painter.
No, he wasn't.
I like it. It's all in the book.
You have to keep your eye on frustrated artists. Because in their insecurity and frustration, they will take their wrath out on the entire world. So next week we'll cover 20. If we don't get done with Kings, we can finish that first Wednesday of October. And whoever comes thinking that they're going to get to start on Daniel will just have to rejoice with us in the conquest. I've enjoyed it.